Hello, I think I'm recording. It looks pretty good. Okay. Boker Tov. It's Shabbat morning, the 22nd.
Second.
Let's have a vote. How many for 22? All right. It's the 22nd of March. 2014, we're at Narkis for the 9:45 Bible study. Today we're going to do a little CSI. We've looked at the passage before, of course, but I was having fun, and I liked the metaphor, the comparison with CSI, crime scene investigation. And for the last decade on television all over the world, people have enjoyed watching CSI. Somebody says no. Well, for all the rest of you, if these are shows that multiplied. It started off in Las Vegas. They added New York, Miami. And what happens is they look at something happens bad, and then the police come in to investigate, and while they do that, there's usually a few false leads. They think they've got the right person, but somebody down inside doesn't feel right about it and says, no, dig deeper. Something else is going on. And then they dig deeper. What do you know? They find out that, in fact, the culprit is off at right angles over here, and then they find him and get him. So that's the general scenario. And here, of course, it's not something bad. In a sense, it's something good. But it allows, we're going to be looking at a problem that will allow us to dig and try to get the details right. And it will seem a little bit like CSI. They go and look at the DNA and the fibers and this and that, and we're going to be looking at details today, and you're going to see how this can contribute to biblical interpretation. A friend of mine, Stephen Fahn, said that living in the land and researching biblical topics here is like CSI, because we're where it happened, and so we get to see the lay of the land, the physical background, and if you live here and you apply yourself, you can learn the cultural background and the language background that are so important for interpreting the whole, I guess they would call it the res geste, the whole body of evidence. And so that's what we're going to look at, and we're going to start with, we're going to be looking at the sower. I suppose I could read it. Oh, I didn't bring anything English. It's a lot smoother to read if you just read from English. And also, it gets rid of the personalities involved, because you get somebody else not involved to get their report. So, let me read the sower. I'm going to read it quickly from Mark, then I'm going to read it from Luke.
Mark's what chapter?
It's the fourth chapter. Listen, a farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched and they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants, so they did not bear grain. Still other seed fell on good soil. It came up, grew, and produced a crop. Some multiplying 30, some 60, some 100 times. Whoever has ears to hear, let them hear. Now, flipping over to Luke chapter 8. I'll begin with verse 5. A farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path. It was trampled on, and the birds ate it up. Some fell on rocky ground, and when it came up, the plants withered because they had no moisture. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up with it and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on good soil. It came up and yielded a crop 100 times more than was sown. Whoever has ears to hear, let him hear. Thank you. And I'll have to get that open in a bit. And we're going to want this open a little bit later, too. So, first of all, what's the problem? Actually, just from listening to the English, there shouldn't be much of a problem. Although, if you've listened carefully, there was a slight difference at the end. In Mark, it said some they produce fruit, some 30-fold, some 60-fold, some 100-fold. And when you go over to Luke, it just said, and a crop grew up 100-fold. So that kind of clue might tell you something about the punchline and how to interpret the parable, or how it was expected to be interpreted, and how the original audience would have heard it. And I'll just throw out a hint at this early stage. For instance, in Luke, where it says 100-fold, who knows, in the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, where we have 100-fold. In other words, if this could be a hint to a punchline, where do we have 100-fold in the Hebrew Bible?
In Genesis.
Yes. Jacob goes off. He's been down in Gerar, and he comes back.
Not Jacob.
Isaac.
It's Genesis 26. He comes back and plants and gets 100-fold. He is blessed by God. And people have debated this 100-fold. Mark also has 100, and does Matthew have 100 at one point? Mark 30, 60, 100. Matthew has 100, 60, 30. Luke has 100. They all agree on 100, and commentaries have divided whether that is to be considered special, extravagant, miraculous, or just the far edge of good. And people have brought quotes from ancient authors where ancient authors have mentioned 100-fold, and they say, see, this was normal. People could be expected to have that. Others have said, no, the people that quote 100-fold in antiquity are telling tales from far away. And for them, 100-fold, like for us today, would be far and above. If you expect 10-fold, 100-fold is far and above what you would expect. And people do tend to have, when you quote something from far away, you remember it as little kids maybe. Oh, but on the other side of the world, this happens. Well, has that other little kid been to the other side of the world? No. But if you push it far enough away, then you can talk about crazy things. And you can also be doubted. In the United States, when the first reports came back from the West, the whole eastern United States is covered with trees. They had forests everywhere. Valleys up and down the mountains, pine forests, very thick wooded areas, but they were normal sized. And they heard these reports coming from California that there were trees whose trunks were as big as houses.
Yosemite,
the sequoias. And other people, when they heard that, they said, you must have been eating some of that some of that cactus we've heard about. Or the loco weed, or, you know, that's, trees don't grow that big. Well, in this case, it turned out to be true. Anyway, so in antiquity, the fact that some authors mention a hundredfold from far away doesn't mean that these were not considered almost legendary, fabulous. And in the Bible, a blessing from God. It's very clear that when, in Genesis 26, when the hundredfold crop comes, that was considered a special blessing from God. And those that would have an ear, especially if you heard it in Luke's version where you just hear the hundred, you can pick that up. If you know your Hebrew Bible, then you pick that up and you go, oh yes, truly blessed by God. But we're far ahead of ourselves. Let's come back to this phrase, and I'm going to read you some things that are stated. If we were to read this parable today in Greek, using our typical Greek texts, which are modern, eclectic, and edited, we would hear, as we read Mark, Kaala episenistein gen ten kalein ke evidu karpon anavenonda ke avxanomena ke eferon en triakonda ke en exekonda ke en ekaton. And this phrase I've written on the board, en triakonda. And what you don't hear in the way I pronounce it, because I'm using a first century pronunciation, I'm just saying N, but etymologically, that could have come from a word that used to be pronounced hen, which means one, or it could come from another word, N, that means in. And up until about the 9th century, nobody bothered to write accents. So when the New Testament was written, Matthew, Mark, Luke, when they're writing this, they're not writing any accents. And you read it and understand it according to the sense. So you could read it. Our modern texts, our Nestle Allant and our UBS and most of our modern editors and all of the commentaries based on them, because they're all using this text, read it as hen. Meaning 1, 130, 160, 100. And our Greek brothers that have the published Apostoliki Diakonia publishing house, they read in. And most of the Greek tradition and the Greek manuscripts, when they started writing accents in order to record these two, they all wrote N. Not all, but almost all of them wrote N. And the lectionaries wrote N. And so we actually have two ways of understanding this as we read it. One of them is N triakonda in 30, with 30, and it was bringing forth fruit with 30, or, as the modern edited texts go, and it was bringing forth fruit 130, 160, 100. So, which one is it? If you're a student of New Testament, you'll go to some of your reference works, and let's hear what they have to say. Bruce Metzger, wonderful scholar, passed away a few years ago, but he was sort of the dean of New Testament textual criticism, and he wrote a commentary on texts. And he says here on this Mark text, the reading that predominates in the manuscripts, excuse me, I have to get rid of something so I can read it, in the manuscripts is N, whether accented N or hen. In favor of the latter, the hen, is the probability that underlying the variance was the Aramaic sign of multiplication, times or fold, the word had. And those of you that speak Hebrew will all recognize, actually we use it in some of our idioms with had, but it's from ehad, one. Had, which is also the numeral one. And so that could explain this, in which case 130 would mean 30 times, 30-fold. And that's how a lot of your translations now follow today. So this, I think I've unpacked this enough. I've got a note here. This may need some unpacking and reinforcement for a wider audience. So I'll pause and take a question or two if this isn't clear so far.
For those of us who have no Greek at all,
exactly.
Where are we going with it? I mean, it's very. So you've got one lot says 30, 60, 100. I've always understood the 100 to be sort of mild exaggeration or blessings plus, 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 but like you said.
Fair enough. Right. Yes, that's good.
But the end of the day is. I hate to say it, but so what? Where are we going?
Very good. Okay. Well, you probably should save that comment for the end of the day. Because in one sense, a person will be able to say, so what? If we go back to this CSI kind of metaphor, it's like, so it was it A or B? Okay, so it was A or B. Throw them in jail, and so what? It's all the same. We get the right one. It has to do with understanding the broad picture about parables and what kind of framework to be interpreting parables, and in a sense, whether we want to seriously focus on 30, 60, 100, or whether we want to seriously focus on 100 all by itself. And which one would be original or primarily taught, and which one might be trying to put a spin on the other?
Randy?
Yes.
I'm a little bit lost. Okay. I was going to say, because I thought I might be the only one, but in a group this size, maybe I'm not the only one.
I don't think you would be. Go on.
But, so are you saying N would be, so in 30, in 60, in 100?
Yes, this one over here would be in 30.
In 30.
And so they were bringing forth fruit in 30, okay, as an idiom meaning thirdly.
Okay. The other one is the hen would be 100.
No.
No?
No. The hen is a word that means one, and it's another idiom, but a different one, 130, 160, 100.
Which equals to fold?
Yes, which is an idiom. In Aramaic, there is an idiom. It shows up in Daniel once, I think, where they heat the furnace seven times, and it says, had shiva, 1-7. And it means seven times. Seven times hotter. And so the question is, well, let me finish unpacking this a little bit. But this hen over here and what is in our Greek texts today is interpreted, according to Metzger, as an Aramaic idiom, which is being written into Greek, of all places. Because Mark's writing in Greek, but Metzger is saying this is probably an Aramaic idiom that means 30 times, 60 times, 100 times.
Which equals 34-fold.
Yes, in English, that's the same way of, yes, 30-fold, 30 times, and that this is an Aramaic idiom. And then that sets the framework for how you interpret things. Yes?
Is it that in the three times, I mean 30, 60, using hen, or here it's another. The first one is,
yes,
130. Another 60. Another 100.
Yes.
Is it the same way?
No, that's a different idiom. We're going to come to that. Thank you. That is another way to read it. And if you think about it, what he's just read and what he said in English actually would work in English, and we would call that an ellipsis. Listen carefully. And others fell on the good ground and were bringing fruit, 130, 160, 100. And so by speaking slowly in English, we would naturally hear that as ellipsis. One seed, comma, would bring, comma, 30. One, comma, would bring 60. And that translation there is what I would call a distributive translation.
Which is the original?
No, that is from the Arabic. The Arabic was not original. I'm sorry. That is a different narrative.
King James.
It's close to the King James. But the King James is not original either. It had a date, 1611. Okay. Now, so we're done unpacking that. Let's go on. I'm going to read a couple more general reference tools, and then we'll get into trying to decipher it. There's a standard grammar of New Testament Greek by Blastebrunner Funk in English. In German it's just Blastebrunner, but Funk updated it and brought it into English. And he says, entriakunda is an Aramaism, Mark 4:8 and verse 20. Mark 4, verse 8 and verse 20. Inferior reading is en, that's the word in. That was in parentheses. And then he says that the N, meaning hen, triakunda, means 30-fold. The comment on the N as an inferior reading, I can unpack that for you and simply say that in a lot of scholarship, the Byzantine majority text is considered inferior. However, it needs to be noted that in this case, the Byzantine text is identical with the Alexandrian text in terms of letters. If you look at those letters, you see an E and a that thing that looks like a V is a Greek nu or an N. And so in terms of the actual letters that you write, when you're writing in all capitals, it looks like this. And that, I probably should have done that at the beginning, then I wouldn't have had to do this, because everybody can read that in English. The capital Greek letters are just like the capital English letters. N. And whether you think of it as etymologically hen, or whether you think of it as etymologically N, is how you read it. Okay? So what he is saying, what that grammarian was saying, is that it's an Aramaism, and the word should have been hen, but an inferior reading, by that he means the Byzantine reading, which is basically the whole Greek-speaking church throughout all history, read that as in. And so anyway, we've now got two witnesses. We have Metzger. He says it's an Aramaism, that it's hen. We've read Blastebrunner Funk. He says it's an Aramaism, hen. Commentaries tend to follow that line. Let me read you one more. I didn't get a chance to write it up into my computer yet. I'm in the middle of doing that. But here we have what would be considered the standard Greek dictionary. So, you know, a student looks at the textual commentary, looks at the Greek grammar, opens up a Greek dictionary, and what does it say? It says, it has a special note at the end of one of its entries, and it says, hen triakunda, Mark 4:8, comma, 20, is probably to be considered an Aramaism 30-fold. See, and he quotes the grammar, quotes a couple other scholarly articles. three witnesses now, our basic reference sources, all agree this is an Aramaism that means 30-fold, 60-fold, 100-fold. So, looks like a slam dunk. And so your reporters have gathered the evidence, your investigators have gathered the evidence, they brought it into the... Is he a lieutenant or a captain in CSI? When they,
it doesn't really matter.
What?
It doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter.
Your expert witnesses.
Yes, our expert witnesses and our investigators have written up their reports, they brought it in, and they're ready to turn it over to the DA now for prosecution. They think they've got it nailed. And of course, if Jesus is speaking this parable, we could explain an Aramaic idiom as having the parable taught in Aramaic, which is what most of these investigators are assuming as part of their worldview. So they bring it to their chief to get the stamp of approval, and he goes, "Wow, this is shut, you know. It's a shut, open and shut case." Except the day is late, he goes home, sleeps on it, comes back the next morning, and something's bothering him. And something for us here in the land, something bothers us, and I'll get to what it is in just a second. But if you noticed, when I was reading from the lexicon, he said, probably an Aramaism. Okay, probably. That means it might be something else. But he didn't tell us what the might be something else was. And so then that starts to clang. Well, maybe might be something else is referring to what the grammarian said. Maybe it might be this word N. Or it might be another way of interpreting this word hen, according to the English or Arabic, like we've said. But what bothers me and what little flag tells me that there's more to this picture than is going on? And the thing that immediately bothers me, that many of you have heard if you've been to these Bible studies in the past, in what language is over 50% of parables taught in? Okay. In what language is over 99% of the parables taught in?
Hebrew.
Yeah, in what language is 100% of the parables taught in?
Jesus.
Hebrew. Hebrew, yes, that's right. That they don't tell you in Bible schools today in Christian circles.
They don't know to tell you.
What?
They don't know to tell you.
Most of them don't know to tell you. There are people that know and just can't believe it. Because they've heard, if you hear 1,000 scholars tell you that Jesus taught the populace in the Galilee in Aramaic, and he was teaching parables in order to popularly communicate to the populace in Aramaic, and you've heard that your whole life, and somebody comes along and tells you all the Tanaitic and Rabbinic parables are all in Hebrew, you'll just say, that doesn't fit, and you just simply block it out, especially if you're not fluent and happily reading this literature. It's just something that clangs and it doesn't fit, and it's just like one drop against 1,000 of a chorus that you've heard.
How do you prove that?
How do you prove which?
That he told the parables in Hebrew and then everything else in Aramaic.
You can't prove that.
Well, how do you know then?
Well, what I was saying is that rabbinic, one of the things that rabbinic scholars have known, and this is old information, they've known that parables were always done in Hebrew.
Right.
And we've got Segal was a scholar who wrote a grammar of Mishnaic Hebrew, and one of his little notes in there is certain things as a genre just are always done in Hebrew, and one of them was parables. Just
So everybody knew Hebrew and Aramaic.
Everybody, well, and that's another point, is that scholarship in Israel over the last 100 years that have been investigating the language have reversed what was the consensus of the 19th century. In the 19th century, at the end of it, New Testament and a lot of Jewish scholarship had come to a conclusion that Mishnaic Hebrew was artificial. And during the last century, particularly Israeli scholarship, looking at the data, has said, wait a minute, this doesn't add up. You know, look at these features, look at this, look at this, look at that. And they flipped it around and said, no, Mishnaic Hebrew was a development of Hebrew during the Second Temple time, and it was a diglossic situation. Diglossia is where you have two levels of language. Mishnaic Hebrew was a low level. What are low levels? Those are popular language levels. High levels, formal. You go to Switzerland, they write Hochdeutsch. 99.9% just like Hochdeutsch of Germany. There's a couple little differences. But they speak totally different.
Right.
And
right.
And the same thing is true of Arabic. You write one way, you write Tahira, and you say Tayara. Tiara. Yes? Yes, question.
No, not Arabic. No. Something came to my mind.
Okay.
You brought the metaphor of crime investigation.
Yes.
You know, Hollywood brought us, you know, all the time what the police officers, all those experienced and well-educated. Then, most of the time, they introduce a different personality, like Colombo, Kojak, Ironside, who overcame the, you know, experts.
Yes.
I mean, which applies also to theologians, philosophers, historians, etc., etc. So there is a hidden...
Okay. Well, I'm not sure how that applies. Let me go on. So I'm trying to find out where... I want to investigate and say, where is this coming from? Because I have a sense that my investigators didn't tell me everything. And so I started looking at the text, and I find out... one of the things I find out is that some things have actually been done rather sloppily. These Greek texts have footnotes, and in the footnotes, different editions will cite who is, you know, which manuscript side with one thing or the other. And the third edition of the UBS text, I didn't bring it with me, it said that most of the Greek lectionaries read hen. And then in the fourth edition, it said most of the Greek lectionaries read n for these things. Strange. And then there's a famous manuscript called Bizet, D. And in my third edition, it said that Bizet reads hen. But in the fourth edition, it says it's ambiguous. That's correct. Bizet is an old uncio that just wrote these capital letters. It didn't write hen or n. But one of my texts that was, you can consider it standard up until about, 1990. The fourth edition came out, I think, in the 1990s. And in the fourth edition, they corrected some of this bad stuff. So my investigators are committed to getting it right, but they were listing things wrong. And so I was trying to say, okay, what really is the text? And so yesterday I was online. There's a family of manuscripts called Family 13, and they were listed as having hen in Mark 4:8. And you can actually find two of them online, get the picture, draw it up. One was a 12th century, I think, the other 15th century. And you can go up and look and magnify it and see. And they've added the little marks so you can see which one they read. And yes, family 13, of all the Greek manuscripts, family 13 does read hen. Whoopee-doo. All the others don't. But still, I was thinking, okay, good. And then in verse 20, it turns out family 13 jumps over here and records it as N. I'm going, now that's strange. What is going on? So I said, you know, I'd like to know where this is coming from, because how are these people reading this? How did this family 13 get such an idea? And so I was trying to track things down, and there's other translations. We can go to Latin, we can go to Coptic, we can go to the Peshitta and Syriac. Now, Syriac is a Greek name for Aramaic. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, I really need to look at the Syriac, because the Syriac is Aramaic, and that will, if this truly is an Aramaic idiom of all people, they'll get it right. We'll come to that in just a second. First, Latin. Latin translates it as unum, unum triginta, 130, exactly, unum. You all know unum from English. So Latin goes this way, and I'm going, wow, that's very interesting that the Latin tradition would go that way. Well, in Coptic, the Coptic has a word that means other, you know, or some. You know, some would do this, and others do this, and others do that. And I'm going, I wonder what that is. And we probably won't have time, so I'll just tell you that there is a Greek idiom where you can multiply 1, 1, 1 distributively. Like in John, when they come in and they see the angels, and it says, he saw them sitting there, one at the head and one at the foot, at the feet. So there is this idiom in Greek, and the Coptic picked that up, translated it accordingly. I'm saying, okay, that's very good. Now, what did Mark write, and what did the Peshitta do? Or what did the Syriac traditions do? And so we have one manuscript of the old Syriac that was found in the 19th century, and guess what it says? No guesses? Okay. This Syriac says, Beat Latin. Beat Latin. Anybody that knows a little bit of Hebrew can hear that and understand that. With 30. I'm going, now that's incredible. How would a second, possibly as late as third, but almost certainly second century translation, these are people, you know, come up with this. Now, these are people that are bilingual, Greek and Aramaic. They know they're Greek. They're living at a time when it's part of their second mother tongue. They're living where they're using both languages as a little kid. They grow up with them. And didn't they recognize their own idiom? 130 meaning 30-fold? How come they, of all people, didn't get it? I thought, well, that's strange. Let's see if they picked it up and corrected it later. So I go to the Peshitta, which is a 5th century Aramaic translation. And in the 5th century, it says, in verse 4:8, it says, eth det Latin, there are of 30. There are of 60. There are of 100. I'm going, well, that's strange, because that's not their idiom, 130, 160, 100. Didn't they recognize? What is that? And it looks like some kind of a free translation, trying to make sense of it. So then I looked at verse 20, because remember, in Mark it happens both in verse 8 and in verse 20, and the Peshitta in verse 20 says, Beat Latin. I'm going, very strange. My Aramaic, of all people in antiquity, my Aramaic reads this way. And in fact, in antiquity, I could not find one translation that read this as specifically 30-fold. We can get the distributive 1, 30, like some did this, some did that. And then I asked myself, we've got to wind up here soon, so we're going to skip a bit. I asked myself, how am I going to read Mark? And how did Matthew read Mark, for instance? Now, Matthew, I didn't read Matthew for you. Matthew says, some 30, some 60, some 100. It has a word, it doesn't really mean some, it means sort of like that which. O men triakonda, o de exekonda, o de ekaton. At least two or three of you will have followed that. And so Matthew is reading distributively. I'm not sure that he thought Mark wrote distributively. Distributive means, you know, one did this, one did this, one did the other. And my problem with the distributive reading of Mark is this. When you see this idiom used in Greek, and it says one did this, one did that, one did that, it literally means one. Like with those angels in John 20, one at the head, one at the foot. And so if Mark wrote this and he meant one did 30, one did 60, one did 100, then he would be saying others fell in the good soil. One did this, one did this, one did this. And it wouldn't really be distributive meaning some. It would literally mean one. And I found a commentator that actually pointed that out, and I was kind of chuckling because I think he was being misled by these manuscripts, thinking he had to read one, and he says, well, duh, it means one. It's not the Greek idiom for several, it's the Greek idiom for one. So we have three interpretations, and I was wrestling yesterday with basically two, because we have two Greek word possibilities, and in our major reference works we divide it up into two possibilities. In fact, there's three. There are the two, there's the Aramaic idiom, there's this en triakonda idiom, meaning with 30, and then there's this distributive metaphor, but the distributive one seems to be fixed on one. And so as I was reading it and looking, we're talking about seeds, the sower going out to sow, and he's throwing seed all over, and it's very multiplied, and I thought the one seemed a poor reading, and I think Matthew did not read one as one. I think Matthew was actually reading this with 30, and he was just putting it into another Greek form. Some did this, some did this, some did that, which is what a lot of good translations also do. And so then I came down and I said, okay, so what did Mark write? Did he write this, or did he write this one over here? And my Aramaic translations all tell me he wrote this, which to me tells me a lot. And then the majority Greek texts throughout the history of using these texts, they also read this as N. And so I've come to the conclusion that it's a Greek idiom. Mark wrote a Greek idiom with 30, with 60, with 100. It's Greek. It's not Aramaic. That makes good sense to me, because I don't think the parable was taught in Aramaic, but I'll close with that in just a second. And
so what does it mean with 30?
It's like 30-fold. He's come, you know, and so, as it were, you know, he throws seed out. And so the different seeds, some of them come with 30, some of, you know, they bear fruit with 30, they bear fruit with 60, they bear fruit with 100. The point is that the language chosen to express that is the word with, the word in or with, and not the word one.
So it has to do with the harvest?
And it has to do with the harvest, yes.
But it agrees with the Syrian, the Latin.
Yes, not the Latin. This agrees with the Aramaic translations, not the Aramaic imagination of New Testament scholarship, but with the actual Aramaic translators from 1800 years ago. They were reading this way. And I thought, this is very strange.
Is it an example of a little bit awkward Greek preserving a very clear Hebrew idiom?
Well, Hebrew you can use. We have some instances of 1-1 being used distributively in Hebrew. But I don't think it's coming from Hebrew. I think it's actually coming from Mark. This is Mark, but I'll come to that in 2 minutes.
Something just dawned on me. Maybe I'm a bit slow. One of the things that we've all struggled with over years is to understand that Jesus spoke Hebrew, and that when the scriptures were written and translated into Greek, they took Hebrew idioms and put them into Greek. And they can sound ridiculous, like if you put English into something and you talk about...
But this one doesn't sound ridiculous.
No, let me just finish.
Okay.
Because if you take an English idiom like, I don't know, it's raining cats and dogs, and you put it into something, it makes absolute nonsense and you miss the whole point. Now here, what you're saying, what I'm hearing you say, is for once we're taking a Greek idiom and putting it into Greek, which then gets translated into English or Aramaic or whatever it happens to be. And that's where we get into the sort of confusion. Is that what you're saying?
Partially. What I'm saying is that Mark wrote with a Greek idiom. And the ancient Aramaic translators from Greek understood the Greek correctly and translated it correctly into Aramaic. And none of them had anything to do with this 20th century reconstruction of an Aramaic idiom. That this Aramaic idiom, in effect, was bogus. That it was conjured up and put into the tradition. And most of our commentaries and our reference materials now are based on that. But in antiquity, nobody was thinking that way. So then I come back and I say, okay, what is going on here? If this is a Greek idiom, then where is it coming from and who has what? If I go over to the parable in Luke, I find several clues that actually point back to Hebrew. One is this phrase, and I've shared it before, I'll enumerate them in 1 minute now. Fell on rocky soil. Rocky in Greek, good word. Rocky in English, good word. In first century Hebrew, they didn't have a word rocky. They would say soil of rock. And they used a noun of rock, of bedrock, selah. And in Luke, it says fell on the soil of rock. I'm going, that's strange. Why would he correct Mark and take rocky and turn it into this idiom that happens to line up with Hebrew? Another place. In the explanation it says, for the third group that is, they're choked. It says, and they're going and choking. Going and choking? Where are they going? And some commentators have said, going is a strange word here. It doesn't make any sense because nobody's going anywhere. Why are they going and choking? And people said, oh, well, they're going off into the world and being diverted and getting choked by all the cares of the world.
Perfect Hebrew.
What?
Perfect Hebrew.
It's perfect Hebrew, of course, because, and somebody else is laughing in the corner, because they know that, you know, the people in the boat with Jonah, the storm was growing and getting bigger.
Holech ve-mitgaber.
Holech ve-gadel.
Holech
ve-soer. Going and storming, meaning it gets stormier and stormier. And if you think about it, that makes perfect sense, because this choking is kind of a slow process. The weeds, they grow up slowly and strangle you, but it's a process and it grows and it gets stronger. And Luke has that preserved. Again, something that is excellent Hebrew. Luke also has the punchline that would give you a midrashic reference back to the hundredfold. And so I read the original parable as having a midrashic reference to the hundredfold. Luke has it. He has the ekatomplasiona correct. It's not according to the Septuagint. It's not the word the Septuagint uses at that place, which again is a clue to me that says Luke has received this tradition. He did not make it up. He didn't invent that on stone. He didn't invent that getting stranglier and stranglier. He didn't invent this hundredfold witness. You're actually getting to see and hear the res geste, the data of how the tradition was coming. And so that helps us, it helps me then read. I can read Mark and say, Mark is a secondary telling. Still true, but Mark is the one who has smoothed it out into 30 and 60 and 100. And he's taken the 100 and he's made it, he's tried to make it apply a little more naturally, which is good. It's nice to have that application. He's done it in good Greek. Matthew has come along and has read this, and he read Mark, he read him correctly, and then he smoothed it out a little bit, because this idiom isn't the most common in Greek. It is used, it is attested, but not the most common. And so Matthew was thinking, well, I'll just make this clearer, but he had also seen the tradition in that Luke had received, and that's why in Matthew it starts off with 100. And so some did it, some brought 100-fold, and oh yes, some brought 60 and some brought 30. So Matthew in a sense harmonizes between the two traditions and has seen Luke's, has bettered Mark's grammar a little bit, and I believe it is Matthew that has caused our Latin traditions. Part of my question at the very beginning was to myself, where is this all coming from? How are they developing this? Where did the Latin come up with their unum? And I think the Latin came up with their unum because they were reading Mark through the lens of Matthew.
Which is really a fleshing out of the midrashic connection that Luke makes, and so it's not a bad retelling.
I'm not saying it's a bad retelling. I'm simply trying to get all of my players lined up right so that I can get the big picture, so that as I read parables, I see where they're coming from, I see the background, I see where they fit, and I don't get these nagging little things that clang in the background saying, ding, something didn't fit here. So in that sense, it's a little bit of a CSI. So where is the Latin coming from? The Latin is coming from rereading Mark through the lens of Matthew. And the Hashi'urtam. Okay, so the take-home message is, exactly, the take-home message is be good soil and produce 100-fold fruit. Okay? Amen. Shabbat Shalom.
Shalom.
No, it doesn't alter the interpretation. What, in a sense, whether you read Mark or Luke, it doesn't. But it does affect. It does affect your worldview. It changes your worldview from one to another. Okay, but I'm talking about the Greek text in the New Testament.
Yes.